So we'll just continue right on in the study that we were doing of chapter 8, paragraph 8 in the Crucible of Credible Creed. The wonderful discussion regarding the irrigation system developed during the time of the patriarch Joseph in Egypt and named in part after him as regards the canal, the Bar Yosef, which was Joseph's canal, and provided the Fayum region with all the water necessary to enlarge or continue to fill the Lake Moeris, named after the pharaoh whose name was Amenemhat III, and also he had the name Moeris. But he was identified by us in our articles as having been the elder son of Joseph, Manasseh. And the reason we say that too is because the god Poseidon in the Greek mythology, the word Poseidon means Lord of On, and Joseph had a connection with the city of On in Egypt because he married the daughter of the priest of On, Asenath. But also, we see that that's significant because Poseidon had his symbol, the trident. And the trident was also a pitchfork, which was used in the harvest in typical, you know, land laborers, you know, in land labor type of operations. In those sorts of works, the trident had the meaning of a pitchfork. And, of course, we know Joseph was famous in the Bible for having solved the problem preventing the famine from overcoming Egypt when he stockpiled all the grain. That was a famous story from the book of Genesis in the Bible. So the trident is the perfect symbol for Joseph as Poseidon. And there's so much evidence, therefore. It's all the circumstantial evidence that proves that the Greek mythology had its basis in the Hebrew patriarchs. It's remarkable, is it not? It's phenomenal. It's undeniable. And the genius of the ancient design, speaking about the irrigation system of the Fayum region, which we might attribute to Jehovah as the God of the Hebrews and of the patriarch Joseph, is underlined. This genius is underlined by the damage done it by the Greeks, as we talked about yesterday, how they damaged the Lake Moeris in the Wadi Rayan system of irrigation. They damaged it by trying to gain more we read this yesterday. They tried to gain more acreage, and that instead ended up losing acreage by causing large areas of rich soil to revert to dusty sand. But the other thing is, the Greek engineers, the Roman engineers who came after the Greeks. So the Greeks did damage, but the Roman engineers also did damage, and they came after the Greek engineers, and they had the same, they experienced the same failure, the same result of failure as did the Greeks. It doesn't specify here what their failure was, but they failed as well. And so we see the difficulty of the problem, and also the skill required in order to succeed was quite large if both the Greeks and the Romans failed, whereas Joseph had succeeded and the Hebrews in Egypt had succeeded. Mr. Cope Whitehouse deserves recognition. We've talked about him as being important for his revealing of the antiquity and ingenuity of the canal, Bar Yosef, Joseph's canal, the official discovery of the Wadi Rayan which is this whole system of waterworks, is attributed to him by Colonel James Halifax Western of the Public Works Department in Egypt. That is, the modern-day discovery given as 1886 of the Common Era, and by 1890, Mr. Cope Whitehouse had also proposed the use of Wadi Rayan as a flood escape and an irrigation drain, the same purpose which came to fruition in 1973 CE. He proposed it by 1890, and it came to fruition in 1973 CE. That's 83 years later. Colonel Western thus describes the Wadi Rayan. This valley, a depression in the Libyan desert, discovered by Mr. Cope Whitehouse in 1886. He gives credit to Mr. Whitehouse. This date being taken as the first official communication to the Department of Works of a survey verified by lines of levels, as distinguished from aneroid observations. Aneroid meaning without water. Evidently meaning, he means without considering the water flow would be one way of doing a survey, whereas using lines of levels, you need to consider, or that results in you having considered the water levels and therefore the water flow. Mr. Cope Whitehouse said in reply that the difference between 80,000, now this is another quote taken within the context of the communication by Mr. Western, or Colonel Western there, Mr. Western. Mr. Cope Whitehouse said in reply that the difference between 80,000 Egyptian acres cultivated once a year and not less than 2,300,000 acres of sephi, or summer cultivation, was in itself a reason why the reservoir scheme must be considered preferable if feasible. Difference between 80,000 acres and 2,300,000. A large difference. In any event, there is no risk incurred, Mr. Halifax continues. Long before any part of the water which had been poured into the Rayan Basin could be discharged again into the Nile, the problem would have received a practical and final solution. And Mr. Halifax also continues, if the water proved unfit for use, the canal would nevertheless have paid for itself as a flood escape. Flood escape, in other words, you know, relief from the flood of the Nile. And as an irrigation canal for the Rayan district. Now, when he says proved unfit for use, sounds like he's saying drinking water. That's what it sounds like he's saying. Because he mentions the irrigation canal as though it's still suitable for irrigation. He might also say that if the Rayan Basin was the Lake Moeris of the Ptolemaic maps, we have the experience of 2,000 years to put against a conjectured possibility. Well, it's more than 2,000 years from about 1850 BCE to 1890 CE is more than 3,700 years. But, of course, there wasn't that much experience because a good part of the time was wasted when the Greeks modified things. And their problems were not improved by the Romans. To put against any conjecture possibility, they have the experience of 2,000 years. In other words, there was some 2,000 years when this... There were some 2,000 years when this Wadi Rayan was functioning. He would, however... He continues, ask the Inspector General of Irrigation for his opinion. So this is Colonel Western writing to evidently the inspector. Okay. And we conclude now with the comments of yours truly, I realize that the discussion of the irrigation systems in Egypt has gone on in a lengthy fashion here, prohibiting a more thorough examination of other information, and yet an awareness of the great antiquity of the events of the life of Joseph, the great Egyptian ruler, has allowed us to spend valuable time on the subject, as it is precisely the study of these matters which currently offers to best inform us. Having documented these things only briefly, we break off. That concludes that paragraph 8 in the Crucible article. One further comment for today I would have is that the article Phoenix is the article that talks about this at great length with regard to discussing I'm looking for it here. I was just looking at it a moment ago. Where is it? Here, this is it. Yeah. With regard to the identification of Hercules, and we know that this great Egyptian pharaoh, Sesostris III, was characterized as a very large, tall, and strong man who would fit the description of Hercules also. And we've identified him as the son of Joseph, the younger son of Joseph, that is, Ephraim. Even the word Pharaoh, it talks about in the article Phoenix, has a lot of similarities to the name Ephraim. Pharaoh and Ephraim, with the English, you know, PHR being common between the two names, or the idea of Pharaoh being maybe originally the name of Ephraim, and that the title of Pharaoh came from the name of Ephraim, is quite a remarkable conjecture and a sensible, reasonable postulate made in the article Phoenix. There are many things in the article Phoenix that are just staggering in their implications, and they ring so true in so many ways. Oh, there's so many good things in there. Even the desecration of the statues of the pharaohs, Sesostris II and Sesostris III, as well as Amenemhat III, all being desecrated in a similar way, which hints at anti-Semitism. It also remarkably agrees with everything we've been saying about this whole topic. Now, that's it for the Crucible article and the Phoenix article for today. Now, we've got our study from 2 Chronicles 5. Before that, we want to look at today's scripture, Little Children, from Proverbs 14:1. A wise woman builds up her house, every wise. The foolish one wrecks by her hands its demise. A wise woman builds up her house, every wise. The foolish one wrecks by her hands its demise. 2 Chronicles 5, finally, all the work that Solomon had to do for the house of Jehovah was at its completion, and Solomon began to bring in the things made holy by David his father, and the silver and the gold and all the utensils he put in the treasures of the house of the true God. It was then that Solomon proceeded to congregate the older men of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chieftains of the paternal houses of the sons of Israel, to Jerusalem, to bring the Ark of the Covenant up of Jehovah up from the city of David, that is to say, Zion. Now that couldn't have been too far from where the temple was, I mean, because the temple itself was on, as far as we understand, it was on Mount Moriah. Wasn't that also in the city of David? It was, I believe it was. These were very nearby, it would sound like. But anyway, wherever the ark was, it was not all that close, apparently, from this. So all the men of Israel congregated themselves to the king at the festival, that of the seventh month. That was at the time when the temple had nearly come to its conclusion. in its construction. So all the older men of Israel came, and the Levites began to carry the ark. Wasn't it the eighth month when they completed the work? We can look at 1 Kings 6, and that's the place where we find that. By the way, 2 Chronicles is the 14th book of the Bible canon in the form in which we're using it, which is typically, I'm not sure what we call this form of the Bible. It's not based on purely the Masoretic text, because the Jews have their version of it too, and it's based on the Masoretic text, so it's not purely the Masoretic text. But it says here, in the second month, he built the house, and then it was completed. Where was it completed? Well, we're going to look down to the end of this chapter. There it is. The eighth month, it was finished. You see that? It was 7.5 years from the fourth year to the 11th year, the second month to the eighth month. 7.5 years. In verse 38, we see that. Okay. It's just called 7 years there in the text, but finally it was complete, the work, it says there. But of course, it wasn't quite complete, because this is only the seventh month here in verse 3. So all the older men of Israel came, and the Levites began to carry the ark. Only the Levites were authorized to carry the ark, and they came bringing up the ark, and the tent of meeting, and all the holy utensils that were in the tent. The tent of meeting had been located at Gibeon, I believe. Is that true? We just read about that recently. They had to bring that up. But, of course, the ark was in a different place. It was in the city of Zion. The priests, the Levites, brought them up. And King Solomon and all the assembly of Israelites that were keeping their appointment with him before the ark were sacrificing sheep and cattle that could not be counted or numbered for multitude. Today's studies are relatively short. Both 2 Chronicles 5 and Amos 6 have 14 verses each. Then the priests brought the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah into its place, into the innermost room of the house, into the most holy, to underneath the wings of the cherubs. Thus the cherubs were continually spreading out their wings over the place of the Ark, so that the cherubs covered the Ark and its poles from above. The poles were used for carrying the ark, and they protruded out from each side of the ark. So we picture the innermost room being 20 by 20 cubits, whether long or short cubits, and then the ark appears to have been facing from north to south, or end to end, the poles running from north to south, and the entrance of the temple was to the east. So, and the most holy room was at the far west, the western end, but it was 20 by 20 cubits with the ark running north-south, is what my understanding, with the wings of the cherubs, if I'm envisioning or visualizing it correctly. The wings ran north to south, wingtip to wingtip, the two cherubs facing inward, meaning facing to the south, inward rather than toward the front door. That's my understanding. Two cherubs were standing up facing south with their wings touching, and also touching the walls on each of the north and south walls. And the ark was underneath them, facing also from north, or running, the poles running from north to south. Thus the cherubs were continually spreading out their wings over the place of the ark, so that the cherubs covered over the ark and its poles from above. But the poles were long, so that the tips of the poles were visible at the holy, in front of the innermost room. That's interesting, too. Right, so that helps to understand, too. The tips of the poles were visible at the holy in front of the innermost room, so inside the temple, near the most holy, you could see the tips of the poles. And that seems to suggest where the door was to the most holy, that it wasn't directly center. Otherwise, the ark would have been visible, perhaps, but maybe not, because they were, perhaps it was screened out by the cherubs. So it could have been center for the door. It's hard to understand it fully. But they were not visible outside, and they continue there down to this day. The poles were not visible from outside the temple, whether the angle to the door wasn't suitable or something like that. That's what it sounds like, which suggests the door was not central on the most holy. There was nothing in the ark but the two tablets that Moses had given at Horeb. What were the tablets, little ones? They sound a lot like the ark, not the ark, the tablets of the law of Moses, do they not? The tablets of the covenant given to Moses, inscribed in stone. When Jehovah covenanted with the sons of Israel, verse 10, while they were coming out from Egypt. Verse 11, and it came about when the priests came out from the holy place, for all the priests that were to be found had for their part sanctified themselves. There was no need to observe the divisions. They all came out apparently together. And the Levites that were singers belonging to all of them, namely to Asaph, to Heman, to Jeduthun, and to their sons and to their brothers, clothed in fine fabric with cymbals and with stringed instruments and harps, were standing to the east of the altar, and along with them priests to the number of 120 sounding the trumpets. And it came about that as soon as the trumpeters and the singers were as one in causing one sound to be heard in praising and thanking Jehovah, and as soon as they lifted up the sound with the trumpets and with the cymbals and with the instruments of song and with praising Jehovah, quote, for he is good, for to time indefinite is his loving kindness, end quote. The house itself was filled with a cloud, the very house of Jehovah, not a man-made cloud. This is Jehovah's divine cloud, not something of the art of men. And the priests were not able to stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of Jehovah filled the house of the true God. This is not, that's the end of the reading for 2 Chronicles chapter 5. But this cloud is not something that is humanly understood. I don't believe, we don't have any understanding of it. Although they did use incense in the house, right? They did have an incense altar. But that doesn't fill the house. They're talking about something that was so strong that the priests, it was so holy that the priests were not able to stand to minister because of the cloud. The glory of Jehovah had filled the house of the true God. Remarkable statement there. The glory of Jehovah, that would not be the same thing as incense at all. So it's something other than that that filled the house. It's some kind of miraculous thing, apparently, or thing that's yet to be understood, anyway, by us. Amos chapter 6 now. Now, Amos wrote at the time, as we talked about previously, of the kings Uzziah and Jeroboam, which happened during the time. I'm looking for it here. I had it earlier. There it is. The time of Uzziah and Jeroboam. And Jeroboam was between 826 and 785 in our chronology, which is 9th century, or, you know, as the Insight book says, it's 9th century, or it could be even early 8th century, because we see Uzziah, who's also called Azariah, is 810 to 758 or 757 here. The chronology of the kingship of Azariah. So there's a good overlap between both of those kings from the late 9th century to the early 8th century BCE for that time period of Amos, and he's prophesying about judgments to come upon the northern kingdom of Israel as well as the southern kingdom of Judah. Woe to those, let's read chapter 6, Amos verse 1, chapter 6, woe to those who are at ease in Zion and to those trusting in the mountain of Samaria, that's the northern kingdom, and Zion is the southern kingdom. Samaria the north, Zion the south. They are the distinguished ones of the chief part of the nations, and to them the house of Israel have come. That's a rather interesting statement. Distinguished ones of the chief part of the nations. Those are the ones who are at ease in Zion. And to them the house of Israel have come. That's a rather odd statement. I guess it means that that the house of those distinguished ones in Judah were more distinguished than the other nations, but yet they were at ease, and they should have been aware that there was judgment coming against them. Make your way over to Calneh and see, verse 2, and go from there to populous Hamath, and go down to Gath of the Philistines. Are they better than these kingdoms? Or is their territory bigger than your territory? Are you putting out of your mind the calamitous day, and do you bring near the dwelling of violence? Oh, yes. So were they allowing violence to creep into their own daily affairs and ignoring the coming day of calamity? And then he says, verse 4, you men that are lying down on couches of ivory and are sprawling on their divans and are eating the rams out of a flock and the young bulls from amongst fattened calves, that are improvising according to the sound of the stringed instrument, like in the modern day that would be guitar, right? But it used to be the harp or the lute or something like that, that, like David, have devised for themselves instruments for song, that are drinking out of bowls of wine, and that with the choicest oils do their anointing. And we see again that their wine is not a good thing necessarily at all. In fact, it's not a good thing, typically. It's been presented as a good thing in many places, but we see that there are lots of places in the Bible where it's shown that wine is not a good thing. And they have not been made sick at the catastrophe of Joseph. And the reference to Joseph is really appropriate, seeing as we've been studying Joseph in our chapter in the Crucible article, which was not planned by me again. Jehovah has his hand in that. Therefore, now they will go into exile at the head of those, verse 7, going into exile. He's talking about the upcoming exile, which is prophesied here, and the revelry of sprawling ones must depart. They're going to be punished. They're going to be taken away. Their partying is going to end. The sovereign Lord Jehovah has sworn by his own soul, is the utterance of Jehovah, the God of armies. I am detesting the pride of Jacob, and his dwelling towers I have hated. And I will deliver up the city and what fills it. And it must occur that if 10 men should be left remaining in one house, they must also die. And his father's brother will have to carry them forth one by one, and will be burning them one by one, in order to bring out the bones from the house. And he will have to say to whoever is in the innermost parts of the house, are there any more with you? And he will certainly say, nobody. And he will have to say, keep silence, for it is not the occasion for making any mention of the name of Jehovah. Not that the word nobody has anything to do with the name Jehovah, but there's a peculiar implication there. For here is Jehovah commanding, and he will certainly strike down the great house into rubble and the small house into debris. On a crag will horses run. And here's a beautiful beautiful illustration here. On a crag, on a mountain cliff, will horses run? You know, on a sheer, I mean, that's where mountain goats run. But on a crag, will horses run? Or will one plow there with cattle? You're going to go and plow a field on the tip of a rocky mountain? No, I don't think so. But that's the question asked. For into a poisonous plant you people have turned justice, and the fruitage of righteousness into wormwood. You who are rejoicing in a thing that is not, who are saying, have we not in our strength, have we not in our strength taken horns to ourselves? Look, whatever that means, taken horns to ourselves. Dominance, horns, something like that. Look, I am raising up against you, O house of Israel, is the utterance of Jehovah. Verse 14. The utterance of Jehovah, the God of the armies. The utterance of Jehovah, the God of the armies. I'm raising up to you. I'm raising up against you, O house of Israel, is the utterance of Jehovah, the God of the armies. A nation, in quotes. All this in quotes to the end. A nation, I'm raising up a nation, and they must oppress you people from the entering in of Hamath down to the torrent valley of the Arabah. Interesting, because we've been talking about the Arabah as the place where Solomon at Kirbat and Nahas may have forged the implements of the temple. And if we look back into the chapter 5 of the commentary of, I'm going to look for it here, where is it? There it is. Commentary by Clark on the book of Amos in chapter 5. I missed this before, but later on in the chapter 5 where he talks about the... No, it's not. That's in Chronicles. It's in 2 Chronicles chapter 4, I think. Was it? Yeah, 4. He made the molten sea? Right, yeah. Chapter 4 of 2 Chronicles where he talks about he made them in great abundance, right? But he cast them in the clay ground between Succoth and Zarethan or whatever, Zarethan or Zerida. We also know that from this, look, some suppose, Clark says, that he did not cast those instruments at those places, but that he brought the clay from there. So he may have brought clay from Succoth, between Succoth and Zarethan, and brought the clay down to Kirbat and Nahas and cast them down there. That's what we might gather from that. But that's the end of our study for today, little ones. Hope you enjoyed that. I enjoyed being with you again. It's March 15th, 2024 of the Common Era. Time is 16:21 Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Lib Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.